From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the historical importance of the Beatles. Here's what's happening. Hurricane Sally roaring ashore the northern Gulf Coast early Wednesday, making landfall as the storm threatens to become a devastating flooding problem to the region. The National Hurricane Center said Hurricane Sally made landfall as a Category 2 storm with maximum sustained winds of 105 miles an hour. The hurricane has left thousands without power near the coastal areas of Alabama and the Florida Panhandle. Sally has since weakened to a tropical storm as it brings damaging impacts across the region. In a gruesome and horrific discovery, listen to this, body parts were found inside suitcases in South Suburban Markham, Illinois. Police said the body parts were hauled all the way from Kentucky on a Greyhound bus, and the family of the man who came with them, they had no idea. Police said the man's family suspected something was strange about the suitcases, but nobody expected that body parts that ended up being discovered inside of them. The man, of course, has been held for questioning. I would guess so. Minneapolis City Council members who just 2 months ago moved to eliminate the police department sounded the alarm during a Wednesday meeting about a surge in crime seen by their constituents. I guess so. Council members pressed the police chief about the uptick in crimes that included daylight carjackings, robberies, assaults, shootings, and street racing. I thought we'd assign Howard Bloom to this one. And Howard, what is going on? You defund the police department, of course crime's going to go up.
Well, at first glance, it looks like a crime wave. But on second glance, it looks like a police work refusal, a deliberate police slowdown. Less than 2 weeks after George Floyd's murder on May 25th, nine Minneapolis council members gathered in Minneapolis Powderhorn Park and promised to begin the process of ending the Minneapolis Police Department. That was June 7th. A little more than 2 weeks later, on June 26th, the Minneapolis City Council unanimously approved a proposal to eliminate the city's police department and replace it with what they called a holistic safety force.
Right.
The police have fought back ever since by taking leave and by implementing a work showdown, a police protest, a refusal to work at full capacity. And that police refusal is being amplified by the COVID-19 crisis. Now, according to the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Minneapolis residents now report that, quote, responding patrol officers told them that they weren't enforcing laws and that the bloodshed would continue unless the city hired more police. Many Minneapolis residents complain the police are not even responding to calls at all, and some, according to the Minneapolis Star Tribune, feel afraid to call. Others feel that they're being held hostage by this crisis. The result, according to the Star Tribune, is that 382 people have been shot in 2020, the most in 15 years. Minneapolis has had 59 homicides this year, doubled the year-to-date average by 2015. Violence, robbery, assault, and burglary are above their five-year averages. There was a series of stick-ups in the 12th Ward. The street racing you mentioned has spread citywide. In the area around the George Floyd Memorial, there's gun violence, drug dealing, intimidation, and extortion. And the police have made an average of 80% less traffic stops than normal. Meanwhile, a local conservative group, the Center of the American Experiment, has put up 38 billboards supporting the police with alarming messages like Uptown reels after gunfire and bloodshed and multiple shootings in metro area overnight. Astonishingly, only five out of these 38 billboards have been vandalized. But some of the vandalizations may conceivably have been done by the conservatives themselves. It says Minneapolis City Pages, one billboard, which originally read, "Support our police," was changed to "Shoot our police," followed by the hammer and sickle, and the anarchy symbol. Now, the Center for the American Experiment says that communists are behind this. Yes, the Communist Party of America does have a Minnesota chapter. But in the run-up to the November election, some politicians are using communists as bogeymen. For example, Minnesota Republican Party Chairwoman Jennifer Carnahan tweeted on April 24th, "Was it necessary for Minneapolis to close the beaches for the summer in early April? The Democrats have turned coronavirus into an excuse for extreme communist control," close quote. Meanwhile, the police showdown may be working. One city councilman, Philippe Cunningham, says, "What I am sort of flabbergasted by is colleagues who a very short time ago were calling for abolition are now suggesting that we should be putting more funding and resources into the Minneapolis Police Department." And according to the Star Tribune, an increasing number of council members have begun trying to reassure residents that police will continue to be a part of any revamped safety system.
As I predicted, Howard, if you defund the police department, crime is going to increase. I understand there's some accolades for your book, Einstein, Michael Jackson, and Me.
It was called the best book of 2020 by the New York Weekly Times and its sister publication, the LA Weekly Times, and I am profoundly grateful.
Congratulations. Howard Bloom, of course, his website, howardbloom.net, B-L-O-O-M. Thousands of North Carolina residents were recently told that they had positive coronavirus tests, but it was a mistake. More than 6,700 individuals in North Carolina were told in a text message sent from the Mecklenburg County Health Department that they tested positive for COVID-19, and more than 500 people were told through a county email that they were also infected with the coronavirus. But the results were not correct due to a technical error by a company called HealthSpace, the company they used for contact tracing, according to the statement on the county's website. My gosh. President Donald Trump has announced a vaccine distribution plan and predicted availability as early as October, directly contradicting a much longer timeline offered early in the day by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention director, Dr. Robert Redfield, told a panel of Senate lawmakers not to expect a coronavirus vaccine to become widely available to the most of the U.S. population until the summer of 2021. Amazon.com is going to open up 1,000 small delivery hubs in cities and suburbs all over the United States. The facilities, which will eventually number about 1,500, will help bring products even closer to you, making shopping online about as fast as a quick run to the store. They are going after, of course, the resurgent Walmart company. The Federal Reserve has vowed to keep interest rates near zero until inflation is back on track to overshoot the U.S. Central Bank's 2% target, a bold new promise aimed at bringing millions of out-of-work Americans back to the labor market. Hope that plan works. Nearly half of the New York City residents earning six figures or more have decided to flee the Big Apple during the coronavirus crisis over cost of living concerns, according to a new poll, and they may never come back. Let's check in with registered investment advisor Mish Shedlock. I guess they're fleeing. It's happening in Los Angeles too, Michael.
It's happening in a lot of places here, George, and it's kind of interesting here that the New York story, Governor Andrew Cuomo actually is begging people to stay. He said, "Come back, come back. We'll go to dinner. I'll buy you a drink. Come over and I'll cook." Meanwhile, the mayor of New York, de Blasio, mayor of New York City, has said, "You know, I don't care if they leave." George, that's absolutely the wrong attitude. It's not just the super wealthy that are leaving. It's, you know, anyone who can get out is going. The top three states for leaving for domestic migration are New York, California, and Illinois, in that order. Now, if you look at it on a population adjusted basis, the top three states the people are leaving from are New York, Illinois, number two, and New Jersey. And guess what these states have in common? They have the highest property tax rates. Mm-hmm. I can talk specifically about Illinois. We purchased a house, George, in northwest side of Chicago in 2001, paid $440,000 for that house. Now, over 20 years, I've actually brand new roof right now. We've made a lot of upgrades to the house. I will get less than we paid for it. Jeez. 20 years ago. Meanwhile, my property taxes have gone up from $9,000 to $14,000 a year on a home worth about $400,000. It's no wonder people are leaving, George. And, you know, this idea that we're going to tax the wealthy, there's not enough wealthy to tax. Because when you start raising property taxes on people, it's across the board, and people who can leave will leave. It's happening in a lot of states, and where are they going to? They're going to Florida, they're going to Texas, they're going to Arizona, they're going to Nevada.
You got it. States that don't have income tax. Mish, thank you. Story we have in the news at coasttocoastam.com. A Malaysian student whose cell phone was stolen while he was sleeping has tracked down the culprit. A monkey who took photos and video selfies with the device before abandoning it. You can see the pictures of the little guy on in the news at coasttocoastam.com. Dorothy Kilgallen was an American journalist and television game show panelist. And after spending two semesters at the College of New Rochelle, she started her career shortly before her 18th birthday as a reporter for the Hearst Corporation's New York Evening Journal. In 1938, she began her newspaper column, The Voice of Broadway, which eventually was syndicated to more than 140 papers, and in those days, that was huge. In 1950, she became a regular panelist on the television game show What's My Line, continuing in that role until her death.
Now let's meet our award-winning What's My Line panel. First, the popular columnist whose Voice of Broadway appears in papers from coast to coast, Miss Dorothy Kilgallen.
Gentlemen, and tonight it's a great pleasure to introduce to you our guest panelist, someone who spells wonderful entertainment for all members of the family, the gentleman who stars in The Life of Riley, Mr. Bill Bendix.
Kilgallen's columns featured mostly show business news and gossip, but ventured into other topics such as politics and organized crime. She wrote front-page articles on the Sam Shepard trial, which ended up being the television show The Fugitive, and later the John F. Kennedy assassination. And then she strangely died. In a moment, one of our favorite guests joins us, Mark Shaw, author of Denial of Justice, the reporter who knew too much, and a new book called Collateral Damage. He is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me introduce our guest, Mark Shaw, former criminal defense attorney, legal analyst for CNN, ESPN, USA Today. He did covered stories like the Mike Tyson, O.J. Simpson, Kobe Bryant cases as well. Mark Shaw is an investigative reporter, author of many books. I just mentioned a few of them. He is a member of the American Society for Journalists and Authors and has written for USA Today, The Huffington Post, and the Aspen Daily News. He's a regular guest here on Coast to Coast and generally was with me in March of this year as well. Mark, welcome back. I wanted to get some updates, but I'm glad you're with us, my friend. How are you?
Hey, thank you, George. And I want to say again so much I appreciate your having me on the show. Since I was on the last time, I've probably heard from at least 25 of your listeners who have sent along support or tips or whatever. And you played the What's My Line show with William Bendix and Dorothy there. One of your listeners, I wish I had gotten her name, but I can't quite recall it. She compiled, and you can imagine how long this must have taken, George, but she went through all of the What's My Line shows she could and compiled the, I think it's the 10 or 15 most amazing shows with Dorothy Kilgallen on them. And if people go to YouTube, they can find those, and they're just priceless. So, again, I appreciate your having me on the show because I always hear from listeners, but this one went an extra mile to put all of that up on YouTube.
Great. I remember watching What's My Line as a kid, black and white television, and she would come out, Arlene Francis, Bennett Cerf, then they'd always have a guest person join them, and then they had to guess what the occupation was of everybody. And then every once in a while, they brought in a celebrity, and they had to put blindfolds on to guess who that person was. It was a great show.
Well, it was, and it was a more of an intelligent type of quiz show than we have today. You know, it's like film or television, George, or your show. Your show comes together. It's kind of a magic that brings it all together. That's what they had with What's My Line. Now, people have watched the show after Dorothy died, and it wasn't the same because they had the perfect mix of people, just the ones you mentioned there, Arlene Francis and Bennett Cerf and Dorothy especially. It's a magical show, and I'm so pleased that people all over the world have watched those episodes that never knew or knew much about Dorothy before I was able to write the two books about her.
Well, I got to tell you, your work is just fantastic. I was talking with our executive producer, Lisa, this week, and I said, you know what? I want Mark back on. I've been really rereading your book, The Denial of Justice, and I'm getting into things, and I'm picking up things that I missed the first time around. And it is just fantastic. Yeah. Like, I really didn't understand how good she was as a reporter. She started so young. Her dad helped her get the first job. But she was darn good at what she did.
Yeah, she really was. It's an inspiring story in many ways. You said 18 years old is when she started. And she became what the New York Post called the most powerful female voice in America. And just imagine that. And I'm pleased to say, and I'll be able to announce, they're going to announce this in a couple of weeks, but a major university has asked to have all of my papers, my books, my research books, all of my notes and documents and videotapes, and hopefully even some of the podcasts from your show in their archives. And they became so interested because of what Dorothy Kilgallen represents. They're interested in connecting my research with their journalism department and their and their, you know, communications department, because, you know, she was, and I still think she is, and many people have said, we wish we had reporters like Dorothy Kilgallen today. And so I'm very honored that that's going to happen, and more people will be able to learn about Dorothy. But if you think about the time period, George, that was when, you know, it was even tougher for women to, you know, to get through those obstacles, the gender discrimination and all of that. But Dorothy never worried about that. She just started out and started writing. And I will tell you this, if I could write half as well as Dorothy did, I'd have 25 bestsellers, because she was such a wordsmith. Remember, Ernest Hemingway called her the greatest female writer in the world.
Exactly.
You know, and in the new book, Collateral Damage, I found more of her columns. And when I read them and I see her writing, I'm just amazed, because she was so perceptive of the human condition at the time. And I'm trying to humanize her a little bit more in the new book.
Well, she died November 8th, 1965, 52 years old, which the coroner claimed intoxication and barbiturates, a combination. But you have questioned that, and a lot of other people have too, Mark.
Well, and rightfully so. We'll get to the new book and the similarities between Marilyn Monroe's death and Dorothy's. But with Dorothy, you know, we've got too many of these cases, the Epstein case now, some of these police shootings, other cases that come along where we really never get the facts. There's no transparency. For whatever reason, there's either no investigation or not a thorough investigation. And, of course, that's what just happened with Dorothy. She's the most credible reporter to have ever covered the JFK assassination. I've said it many times. I'm so blessed to kind of have had her guide me along with my research on all of the topics having to do with the assassination. But, you know, Dorothy covered the assassination for 18 months. She was at the Jack Ruby trial. She's the only one who interviewed Jack Ruby. She exposed his testimony before the Warren Commission, before it was supposed to be released. I wasn't there. A lot of these guys that write about the assassination wasn't there. So, weren't there. So, you know, Dorothy is the expert. And I'm so pleased that, you know, in continuing my research with her, I found even more of the expertise that she had during that time period. And that's why, you know, so many people have decided in their own minds that what she found out and what she was going to put in that book for Random House just before she died, you know, is the most credible information about the JFK assassination, for sure.
Was her body moved in the townhouse she was living in New York when she died?
No question about it. And that's some of the new research. It's amazing to me how I find this research. It's like I'm kind of a magnet for the... George, I'm from a small town in Indiana.
Huh.
I'm not the smartest person in the world. It took me 5.5 years to get through Purdue. You know, and yet it's just amazing. In this will be the fifth book now I've written that's touched on the JFK assassination. I have no idea where this come from. You know, today a guy sent me an email, and he says he interviewed Dorothy's two children, 1 year after she died and gave me all kinds of facts about what happened. And it did include the fact that on the night she died, we know what happened. She went to the What's My Line show. You can see that last show and watch it on YouTube, and you'll see how vivacious she was and how well-dressed she was, as usual.
Impeccable.
She went to P.J. Clark's and had a drink, went to a hotel, met a mystery man, and then went home. Well, I've been able to prove that there were three barbiturates in her system, not one.
Hold on right there, Mark. Hold on for a second. We're at the break. We'll come back and pick this up. It's an incredible story. She was interviewing Jack Ruby while he was in his trial. He since died of cancer while he was in jail. It's an incredible story. Mark Shaw back with us in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Mark Shaw with us. Mark, we were talking about how Dorothy's body was kind of moved around. That's kind of weird, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's amazing to me with some of these crime scenes what happens. We now know, and I think we have proven in The Reporter Who Knew Too Much and then Denial of Justice, that, you know, when the police finally came to Dorothy Kilgallen's townhouse, she'd already been dead for several hours. And you wonder then what happened during that time. We now know that there was the FBI came, kind of swarmed the apartment, took out of all of her documents, investigative files, everything like that. And then the medical examiner, a junior medical examiner, not the main one, came and just took a look at a empty second all bottle and decided that she'd overdosed, not checking to see that she had actually died in the bathroom and then was taken into the bedroom. That's been proven. So, you know, you get these situations where, unfortunately, the crime scene is not as it was when she died, and that's what happened with Dorothy. And really what occurred there, I finally interviewed Dr. Michael Bodden, who I think you've had on your program before, about a month or two ago for the new book, and I wanted to ask him why they came up with the solution, the verdict, that it was a combination of an overdose of barbiturates and alcohol, circumstances undetermined. And I asked him why in the world then they went ahead and told the media that she died of an accidental death. And he admitted, he said, it looks to me like, and his name, by the way, was on the autopsy report, basically that they didn't know what happened to Dorothy. And yet they said it was an accidental death. And the main detective on the case, I found a quote from him where he said if he would have known that it wasn't an accidental death, he would have investigated. So unfortunately, you know, with these kinds of cases, everything gets all mixed up, and then you really don't have the truth. You're a man of the truth, George, and we can't really find at times the truth about these kinds of cases.
And what a story it was. And didn't the FBI raid the house, too, and grab some documents?
They did. And these are true crime murder mysteries. All of my books are about Dorothy Kilgallen. The new one is as well, Collateral Damage. But in this situation, you have a true crime murder mystery because I think I told you the last time I was on the show that I had found a reliable source in Las Vegas who told me exactly how Dorothy was set up for the kill. There was a boyfriend of hers, the main suspect, Ron Pataki, who learned about what Dorothy was going to put in the book for Random House. He told the wrong people what happened, this guy told me, this source. And therefore, they had to be able to eliminate her because they couldn't write that. She couldn't write that book for Random House. And so, you know, in that situation, you look at motive, and then you know, we now know with an eyewitness that J. Edgar Hoover sent his agents into her office, into her townhouse, to destroy that file of hers, that thick file of hers on the investigation of JFK. So he becomes even more of a suspect than he was before, as well as Carlos Marcello, the New Orleans Don, who had another motive to have eliminated Dorothy.
Is Pataki still alive?
Yes, he is. And this has been an exciting time since I was on the show last. Some successes and some failures. It's amazing. You know, I've been able to show, you know, the fact that we're still trying to hide the truth with the Ruby trial transcripts, for instance, which are the most important documents about the assassination and clearly show a plot to kill the president. The sixth floor museum at Daley Plaza in Dallas still distorts history with only information about the Oswald alone theory. And then my attempts to get Dorothy an investigation, George, it's amazing to me. Vance Jr., the New York District Attorney, as you know, agreed to do a thorough investigation, and then he pulled the plug after 8 months. I went to New York, I think I told you, in February, and met Commissioner Shea, Dermot Shea, of the New York Police Department. I shook his hand. There's a photograph of him and me on my website, markshawbooks.com. He gave me the name of a detective in his department and the detective's business card, and said that I could communicate with that detective. I got back to my home in California. I sent emails to that detective. None were answered. I left a phone message for him. None were answered. And finally, I realized that what Shea had done was in many ways shameless. He had really lied to me in my face. I don't think he ever intended for the detective to get back to me. And so that really has disappointed me. There's a letter I wrote to Shea that's on my website, markshawbooks.com, complaining about what happened. I filed a Freedom of Information request trying to get them to go forward because of all the new evidence I have about Ron Pataky. It's overwhelming, George, that he was complicit in Dorothy's death. And besides using a fellow officer as kind of a shield here, which I believe is really derogatory with any officer who's under the command of the commissioner of the New York Police Department, a killer is going to go free here unless they investigate. And that this case qualifies on every level as a cold case squad investigation, and yet I can't get them to go after this. I assume your audience, and maybe you as well, are thinking, why is everybody scared of Dorothy Kilgallen's case that happened in 1965?
Right. What did she know?
Exactly. And there's something there. And, of course, we both know when the government is investigating the government, it's an uphill battle. But this little pint-sized woman scares the hell out of people with regard to what she knew about the assassination. Nobody wants to jump into that case at all, but I'm not going to give up. I'm going to keep trying. I'm going to expose what Shea did, and I'm going to try to get an independent investigation.
What do you think Jack Ruby told her in his prison cell?
Well, this is fascinating because, I just got a chill, George, because again today, I think Ruby, what do we know Dorothy did? She lost her file, so we don't have the notes. In the new book, by the way, I have a picture of her in Daly Plaza. It shows she was right there and right at the trial. Where did she go right after the Ruby trial? She didn't go to Washington, D.C. and look into Johnson, President Johnson, or the CI or anybody. She didn't, stay in Dallas. She went to New Orleans. And as we both know, I've looked at the assassination differently than anybody ever has. Why Bobby Kennedy was not killed instead of why JFK was. And when you have that perspective, which is the same one that Dorothy had, I believe, you realize that Marcello, who was pursued by Bobby Kennedy right after Kennedy became Attorney General and had deported him and charged him with racketeering,
and then he got back in again.
Yeah. Bobby killed JFK, so Bobby would be powerless. So that's where Dorothy went. And she successfully had one trip there. Remember, that was a very mysterious trip with her hairdresser saying in the videotapes that I have on the DorothyKilgallenStory.org that when they got there, she called him and said, go back to New York. Don't tell anybody you were here. She goes back to New York, and unfortunately she starts saying, if the wrong people knew what I know about the JFK assassination, it could cost me my life. I'm afraid for my life and my family. I've bought a gun, and she was dead shortly thereafter. So what did Ruby say? Well, today, this gentleman who got in touch with me from Florida told me that he interviewed two of the children of Dorothy, Richard Jr. and Carrie, and while they were talking, they said to him that Jack Ruby had told Dorothy that if he could just get in front of an independent jury, he would tell the truth about what happened.
Wow.
And I think when Dorothy learned that, that's what extended her investigation and into New Orleans. That's where we are right now.
Didn't Ruby know Carlos Marcello?
Oh, it's just amazing.
And Santo Traficante, he knew them both. He was running strip clubs for them, wasn't he?
And if this all goes back to my first book about this assassination, about Melvin Belli, the San Francisco lawyer that I knew and practiced law with in the 80s, who was Jack Ruby's lawyer, and he was all mobbed up with Mickey Cohen and all of that, brought in to silence Jack Ruby. And, of course, then Ruby, we connect easily with Marcello through his underlings, because Marcello's empire, George, extended to Dallas. And you know, there's these little things that Dorothy picked up, and it's amazing to me that people missed them back then. The very first visitor to Jack Ruby in jail was a guy named Campisi. And Joe Savello, Joe Campisi and Joe Savello, but Campisi was the first one. Well, who was he working for in Dallas? Carlos Marcello.
Yeah, exactly.
And Trafficante.
Did the name Jimmy Hoffa come up much, Mark, in your work?
What's that?
Jimmy Hoffa's name, did it come up much?
Yeah, it did. And it comes through an interesting book by Frank Regano, who was a lawyer in Florida. You may have heard his name, but it's called Mob Lawyer. I've suggested people read it. Because imagine this as your three main clients, James Hoffa, Santo Trafficante, and Carlos Marcello. And I interviewed Regano's widow, Nancy, and she was able to tell me about the connections between Hoffa, the gangsters, Ruby, Oswald being. I now have an eyewitness who saw Oswald in Marcello's restaurant in New Orleans. You know, you can easily connect all of those people, and I'll tell you what the common denominator is: common sense. That's what Dorothy was really good at. You know, at the Sam Shepard case or the Lindbergh baby kidnapping case. I mean, she was a better trial lawyer than most trial lawyers.
Right.
She really was.
Well, and in this case too, with the situation with Hoffa, he hated Bobby Kennedy.
Oh, my
hated God. Him with a passion.
Well, I would think you would when the Attorney General of the United States tries to strangle you. I mean, when Hoffa tries to strangle the Attorney General of the United States, yeah, I think that's hatred. And so, you know, they all had a motive. You know, Bobby Kennedy is a big part of the new book, Collateral Damage. I'm going to connect the deaths of Dorothy Kilgallen, Marilyn Monroe, and JFK, and the common denominator there is Bobby Kennedy. You know, it's amazing. You know, you have three deaths there, George, within 40 months.
Yeah.
Marilyn dies in August of 62, JFK November 63, and Dorothy November 65. 40 months, all three of these individuals died, and I've been amazed now at the similarities I've found in each of their lives and their professional and private lives, and then connecting them together with regard to their tragic deaths.
And then eventually Bobby goes.
And then Bobby is killed in 68. And you know, again, common sense. Look, what happened when Bobby Kennedy, when Jack Kennedy died? Bobby Kennedy was powerless. He broke up that huge group of federal investigators, never went after those mobsters again.
That's right. LBJ basically stymied him, didn't he?
He resigned in September of 1967. Then he's going to run for president. Now, many people ask me to write this book about Marilyn with Dorothy and JFK, but they also want me to write about Bobby Kennedy's death, because use a little common sense. Is there any connection between Sirhan Sirhan and the same gangsters? You know, I've never looked into that, but somebody certainly should. Because common sense would say what? These gangsters are now free of Bobby Kennedy, and then Kennedy runs for president. What would be the first thing he would do when he entered the White House? He would go back and investigate those guys for their participation in his brother's death.
Yep.
And remember what Bobby said, and this has been, you know, proven by many other people besides me. What did he say when he heard that JFK had been killed? Well, I thought it would be me.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, mm-hmm. He was right. He knew it was supposed to be him. That's what the prosecutor of Jack Ruby, Bill Alexander, told me. He expected Bobby Kennedy to be killed.
See, they were concerned if Bobby got killed, JFK would assign some other prosecutors to go after the same people.
Absolutely. It doesn't take too much to think that Bobby Kennedy, they couldn't let him become president of the United States. It just wasn't going to happen. You know, Nick Pileggi, you may have interviewed him, an incredible writer, who wrote Wise Guys and those films, he used to tell me, you know, you can't mess around with those mafioso, the Sicilians. It's all about revenge. And I think I may have told you this story before, a personal story. When I was with Good Morning America and covering trials and things, they sent me to Philadelphia to interview the lawyer for Anthony Russo, or whatever his name was, Angelo Bruno, the main gangster in Philadelphia, and they were trying to get into Atlantic City. So I went to Philadelphia. I sat down with this lawyer, and he started telling me things about, the mafia boss that I didn't think he should be telling me. They played that the next day, the tape of it, on Good Morning America, Sandy Hill and David Hartman, maybe your listeners will remember.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, look, will he talk to you again? Because it was a big hit. And I said, well, I'll find out. I called his office. This secretary answered. She was kind of whimpering, and I said, are you okay? And she said, well, I guess you don't know Mr. Shaw. He was sitting in his car this morning, and it blew up.
That was during that time all those car bombings were happening.
You can't mess around with those guys.
No.
And Joe Kennedy, telling JFK to appoint Bobby Kennedy, double-crossing them. You know, it all comes around in life, George, and you know, it's really unfortunate that Jack Kennedy died. He should have never died. That's part of the collateral damage here, as Marilyn is and as Dorothy Kilgallen is in the new book.
Did I ever tell you that I may have been one of the last newsmen to talk to Jimmy Hoffa?
No.
May 1975 in Detroit. I invite him to a TV show I was producing. He came in. He did it. I walked him to his car. We chatted a little bit. We shook hands, and off he went. My theory is twofold, Mark, with Jimmy Hoffa. I think, one, he wanted to regain the Teamster presidency, and the mob was so involved with Frank Fitzsimmons getting better deals than they were getting with Jimmy, they didn't want Jimmy back. But I also think part of me thinks that Jimmy was going to rat on them over the JFK assassination.
Oh, and I've never thought of that.
And so they bump him off. Because they were afraid he was going to talk.
Interesting. Because, well, look, you know, he and Marcello and Trafficante were, you know, three birds together, and Frank Regano connects them completely. So that makes sense. I think I'll try to look into that. Is it all right if I...
Yeah, that could be another book for you.
Use your research here. Yes.
Absolutely. And, you know, mine was firsthand experience. But that I always had that feeling when I was with Hoffa, that it wasn't just the Teamster presidency he was after. There was something else.
Of him, George?
He was a tough, strong unionist. And there were times when companies would abuse the American working man or woman, and they needed a tough president. And in those days, those unions used muscle, as the companies did, to fight back. And he was there at the right time. Ironically, his son is the president of the Teamsters Union now.
I think that's right, isn't it?
Yep, sure is. But I always had that feeling.
That's a slice of history that you, were able to meet and talk with him and all of that. And this all is all about history. People probably wonder, why are we talking about the assassination that happened years and years and years ago? Well, it's about history. And I'm about history, and I'm about abolishing distortions of history, just like you are. We're both looking for the truth. And, you know, these are important things, important issues having to do with history. But, boy, I had no idea about that with your meeting Hoffa. He was a dangerous man, that's for sure. Bobby Kennedy, I think, was scared of him, but he was intent on putting him away. And I don't know if was Bobby Kennedy still Attorney General when they prosecuted him for tax evasion?
They got him put away, and it was Nixon who pardoned him.
He was pardoned? I don't remember.
Oh yeah, they cut a deal. They got him out. Part of the deal to get out with Nixon was that Jimmy would not get involved in union politics anymore. He wouldn't run for the presidency of the Teamsters. I mean, that was the deal they all cut, and he signed it without even reading it, he said. He just wanted to get out, and then he realized that the deal was, you can't run for the presidency. He went ballistic. He went after all of them. But by that, so, I mean, the Teamsters built for the mob Las Vegas, old-time Vegas that has now been taken over by legit corporations, was built by mob by the Teamster Pension Fund. And the mob was the one that took care of it, with Bugsy Siegel and Meyer Lansky and all those people. We're going to be back with more with Mark Shaw. We're going to open up the phone lines. We're going to talk about his new book, Collateral Damage, when we come right back.